90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org, as long as I take the right microphone. Disability in Progress is up next, but first, show us some love. Give us a call, 612-375-9030 or KFAI.org to do your pledge. And thanks for joining Disability in Progress, where we bring you insights into, ideas about, and discussions on disability topics. I'm Sam Jasmine.
I'm Charlene Dahl.
And we are joined by, I don't know, he's kind of been a little bit of a fixture on the program occasionally, John Scallon. Hi, John.
Is that like a plumbing fixture?
Whoa.
Okay, let's start out. Nice.
Yeah, something like, sure, whatever turns your crank. But
okay.
Yeah, you have been on many a times, and we thank you for coming back on. It's good to hear your voice. I feel like we haven't had you on for a while. I know you're, you know, retirement, and you know how those guys get with retirement, but I got to keep you on your toes. So thanks for coming back.
You are welcome.
So, John, you know KFAI is important. All these radio stations now that are kind of holding their own and carrying their weight and then some, now that the funding is not there like it was before, we really depend on our listeners. And you have brought us much info in the years, and you truly know, working in the 501c3 things of the area of things, that what it's like to really depend on the supporters for the monetary part of everything.
Yes, I think individual donors have really been coming through, thank goodness.
Yeah.
For the most part, since we've had uncertainty, at least on the federal level, and of course, for maybe media like KFAI, you know, I don't know if the federal funding has affected KFAI or not, but anyway, individual donors are really, I mean, we're pressed too, but every little bit has helped.
That's right.
And of course, all the volunteers like you and Charlene make it even more economical for KFAI to run. So, but we have to cover all the other costs.
Yes, yes. So thank you again for coming on. And you came on to talk about what's happening locally. We'll be hearing some clips of the previous shows from this year that, you know, people have maybe been interested in hearing about, but you have local stuff going on. What's going on?
Well, since I retired when BSA Minnesota closed a few years ago, right before COVID, actually, one of the organizations that I joined was the Minnesota Access Alliance, which took over BSA's calendar of accessible arts and cultural events. So I'm sort of working with organizations who submit events that are, you know, audio described or American Sign Language interpreted or captioned or offer sensory friendly accommodations or that feature artists with disabilities. And so that calendar is still online, and we send a mini email out once a month. And there's still lots and lots of things to do, even if you know you need those access services. This is where you find out about them.
Yes. Well, you got about 10 minutes, so why don't you give us a rundown of what's going on? Or do you have another surprise?
I'm sorry, my internet seems a little spotty here, so I missed what you just said.
I said you have about 10 minutes, so do you want to give us a little bit of a rundown on what's actually happening, or do you have other things you'd like to announce?
Well, I was just looking at, you know, what's coming up in the next week or so. Mm-hmm. You know, you and Charlene would be interested in shows that are audio described.
Right.
And Saturday, there's Mrs. Doubtfire at
really?
The Ordway. And there's The Importance of Being Earnest, a great classical play at Lakeshore Players with audio describers there. Sleuth is the current show at the Guthrie, and there that will be described Friday night and then a week from Saturday. And that is a good, scary show. Oh, so that would be fun.
Sleuth.
There's also an interesting show that I noticed. It's called An Opera Theater, and they're doing a show in downtown St. Paul, a small show called Opera Captions.
Oh.
And they're looking at different ways that captions are used, both in opera and for people who are deaf, hard of hearing, and the rest of us. And I think that's going to be a really cool show, but it's a very small theater. So if people go to our Minnesota Access Alliance website, they can find those details and find out how accessible it is and so on.
And will they have an audio describe night?
Yes, the audio describe night for that is Sunday, April 5th at 5 o'clock. So you might miss 60 minutes, but I think it would be worth it.
Charlene, can you handle missing 60 minutes?
April 5th is Easter.
Ooh, that's true. I don't know. Well, if you're not looking for Easter eggs, you could have time to go to it. And actually, Easter eggs are usually found in the morning, so totally plenty of time, you know.
Okay, yeah. Yes, it could happen.
What else do you have for me?
Well, I don't know if any of your listeners are interested in other funding opportunities that haven't yet been cut short. But in Minnesota, we are really lucky to have, you know, the legacy amendment that helps provide funding for arts events.
Mm.
And one of the new grants in recent years has been called an Arts Accessibility Grant offered by the State Arts Board. And so organizations can get money to make their facilities, their programs, their staff, their training more accessible. And there's an April 10th deadline. So if any of your listeners have an inkling that they might be able to help an organization become more accessible, so more of our readers, listeners, watchers in the disability community can participate, that would be a great opportunity for them to suggest to that organization to, come on, let's get on the ball, let's apply for something.
Yeah, definitely would be a good thing. And I know, you know, there's been people who've benefited from that. And do you have an idea of what that can all cover? Like anything pertaining to accessibility or changes in venue or what would it cover?
Yeah, it's sort of to help an organization connect better with their community. Yes, you can buy some things, but you've got a $5,000 limit for buying things like caption units or assisted listening devices or whatever. But you can get up to $20,000, so you could have your staff trained. You could do something better with your website to make sure that that's accessible. You could do a ramp. You could offer assisted listening and speakers when you do shows in parks and so on.
And is this limited to like 501c3 people, or can it be any venue that wants to be more accessible?
I believe it's any Minnesota venue that that has either a 501c3. Yeah, I don't think it can be done by a for-profit.
Gotcha.
It has to be 501c3 or with a fiscal agent. So, it's got to be arts related.
Excellent. Okay. And they have till April 10th, you say?
April 10th is that deadline, yeah. There's a different kind of a grant called Arts Experiences, and artists or organizations can apply for that to do shows in the next year that may or may not have anything to do with accessibility, but it's a really good thing for any kind of a grant that you say, okay, how are we going to reach the people who are hard of hearing or whatever? How are they going to find out about us? And mm-hmm. So, yeah, apply for those grants. That's what they're there for. That's what nonprofits are for.
Yes, and we're actually lucky to have those.
Yes, yes.
You know, because a lot of
places, you've benefited too, because you've been in a number of shows that have been put on by very low margin organizations.
Yes, well, you know, if it works, it works.
And in fact, the show that you were in recently, the Off-Kilter Cabaret, you know, that was partly the result of a grant that helped a number of those performances be ASL interpreted, captioned, and described. So that was wonderful.
Hey, I wanted to actually bring something up, an interesting thing. When I was at one of the shows and saw some of the equipment for audio description, it was a flat screen and there were no buttons. And I said, so how does somebody use this? And they said, well, you have to tap, you know, press here. And there was somewhere on the screen, but there was no marks. And I thought, I just kind of bounced my head, right? It's like, this is an audio description device. How could it not be accessible? Have you seen them?
And didn't I hear that you made some suggestions that helped to make that more accessible?
I did, but it amazed me that they would come out with such a thing, you know, that wouldn't be a given, that would be accessible. poor audio describer. She was like, oh my gosh. But yeah, I mean, totally things can be made to be you know, accessible in many cases, but I don't understand when a company is producing something that is going to be used by anybody who is like visually impaired or any type of disability. Why wouldn't you make that accessible in that way for the person with the disability? So seems like a no-brainer to me.
Well, they obviously forgot to get you and Charlene on their arts advisory committee, their accessibility committee.
Absolutely. So, in about 2 minutes or so, we're going to go into another segment. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with, John?
Well, I have some chocolate chip cookies here, but I don't know how to Zoom those, do you?
You know, that's wrong. Just, you should not be saying stuff like that. That's just wrong.
I'm going to take this microphone, and I'm going to...
Well, you know, you can't...
Oh, I had a good cookie. That was great.
You can't chew on the mic, Charlene. But we do appreciate our listeners, and we do appreciate John, and we do appreciate anybody who makes pledges to our programs. All the emails I get, 612-375-9030, or at... Charlene?
KFAI.org.
Yes, KFAI.org.
My tongue got stuck.
Ah, must be all that chocolate chips you're eating.
That cookie with,
All right, well, thank you, John. We really appreciate you coming on. See, told you.
And I will see you at the theater, no doubt.
No doubt. And actually, it'd be interesting to see how they do Mrs. Doubtfire. That would be a fun show. All right.
Yes.
I will talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Charlene, 612-375-9030. We really do appreciate our listeners that support us and listen and, you know, are on the email list. So if you can, give us a call. If you can't do that, go to kfai.org. Give us a pledge. Any amount really helps. Like John said, all amounts count. If you give in the big lines, you can get, you know, tchotchkes or like sweatshirts and things like that. But I actually just really appreciate the people, even when they give little amounts, because it just shows they care, right?
Yep.
Care.
KFAI.org. Do it.
We're going to go to, Charlene, we're going to listen to the first thing we did when we came back from Christmas, our holiday break. It was on eating disorders. Dr. Katie Loth, I interviewed her, and we talked about eating habits during the holidays is especially, difficult, or can be, when it's a problem, when it's not. And so I thought I would share a little bit of a piece of that interview with the listeners. In case you missed it, you can still go on the archives, not the archives, but, you know, you can listen to all our podcasts.
Yep.
Thank you, Aaron. And that should be on the podcast. And it's a great, great show to listen to. But let's listen to a little piece while we wait for people to call 612-375-9030. We're here with Dr. Katie Loth, who's talking about healthy eating habits and eating disorders. Dr. Loth, what are some common ways that people unintentionally might develop unhealthy relationship with food that you might see in your clinic?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll start with what I know most about, right? I do a lot of work with parents and children. So kind of exploring what are the ways that foods are first introduced to children at home? What are the rules and routines that parents set up with their kids? And the reason why this has become such a focus for me in both my research and my clinical work is because I feel like this is when that relationship with food first starts for kids, right? When they're first beginning to explore the idea of eating and trying new foods and beginning to make choices for themselves. And I think that that's a time when it's really important that parents think about kind of how they're introducing those foods to kids and making sure that they're allowing them the opportunity to kind of try as many new foods as they want to, and that they're avoiding language like, you have to eat this to get that, the clean plate club, some of those real pressure to eat or restrictive comments that people can make about food can really start to kind of develop a negative relationship with food and children over time. And then that can kind of build towards some of those risk factors for disordered eating.
Yeah, and you never quite know what's going to hit. I feel like, some kids are more sensitive. I know for me, I was pretty athletic growing up, but I did like my chocolate. And yeah. I had a phys ed teacher that, and I feel like this happens with coaches, and I have for women, for me going through elementary, junior high, high school, I feel like coaches and phys ed teachers, I don't know what that is with them, but I got so many comments and I was not heavy, but they would see me eating a candy bar or something and they would comment on my weight or figure or what that's going to do to me or something. And I think sometimes it's overwhelming, and I feel like that particular area can be damaging to young girls that are really into athletics and want to be athletic, but also might be just eating like a normal teenager. You go home and you have some chips and salsa or you whatever.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I'm happy that you brought up, all the adults that are kind of closest to children, right? So parents play a really big role. Kind of how do they talk about food? How do they talk about weight and bodies? Coaches, teachers, doctors is another big one, right? Like when you go into the doctor, if they're weighing and measuring you, how are they having a conversation with you about that? And how are they making sure that you feel comfortable in your body and aren't feeling ashamed of the way that you're growing? For all of those folks that I just mentioned, so the teachers, coaches, parents, doctors, right? I would say making comments about young people's weight and their body and their growth is really not appropriate, right? It's not something that is appropriate to be doing, whether or not somebody is growing how you think they should or growing in a way that you think they shouldn't, right? Doctors might be the one exception, right? Where if there's a real concern about growth, it might be appropriate for them to bring it up. But when it's these kind of one-off comments that are not associated with real, true medical concern, I think they can be really harmful in long-lasting ways.
Okay. So now, having said that, if you're a parent, because you live with your child every day or whatever, whenever you have your child, how do you approach if you see something going amiss or something wrong that you feel like, boy, this is a lot off the beaten path of what you feel is healthy? How do you approach that?
Yeah. I mean, I think first, I try to encourage, I think, always approaching these things with curiosity, right? Like just talking to your child about what's going on, but without having the focus be on weight, right? The other thing that I think for parents to really think about with their kids in their home is kind of what's the environment that they're modeling for their child overall, right? And this can be particularly important in families with more than one kid, right? You might have one kid that you see and you're really worried about and they're struggling, and you have another child that you feel like is doing just fine, you know, and so your tendency will be to focus on the one, right? But thinking about that whole family environment and what can you all be doing so that you're not singling one child out. So this could be things like making sure you're eating dinner together every night that you're able to. Getting outside in the, maybe not in the Minnesota winter, but getting outside or heading to the Y, going to the pool, you know, doing activities together that are fun as a family. So it's not like, hey, you need to exercise because I'm worried about your weight, but it's more like, wouldn't it be fun for all of us to go shoot some hoops at the Y, right? Or wouldn't it be fun for all of us to take a bike ride after dinner tonight, right? So thinking about how can you be modeling that activity, modeling that healthy eating by having those meals together as a family, setting up some routines around eating. So it's not like rules, but it's like, hey, this is when we have snacks and this is when we don't. This is when we have meals and this is when we don't. And then things like screen time is another big one for kids. Like, how can you be kind of trading out some of that screen time for other activities that your child might like? So you're keeping them as active as you can. But in all of these conversations, steering clear of the, hey, we're doing this because I'm worried about the way that you look, or I'm worried about your shape or your weight, right? It's just, you want them to be healthy, right? You want them to be healthy in their mind. You want them to be healthy in their body. And so all of these activities can play, can kind of play into many, many, many healthy outcomes for kids. And so kind of avoiding that focus on weight and stepping back and saying, this is how we're going to create a healthy family overall.
And there are some good winter sports. I don't want to make
there
it.
There are some good winters. Sledding.
We live in the tundra, but
yeah. And just, you know, even just like, you know, getting outside and even within the home, right? Like when we think about, there are some activities where we're just more prone to snack when we do them. So, you know, it's like you're more likely to have a snack while you're watching TV or on your iPad than you are when you're playing a board game, right? And so it's really thinking about kind of helping your kid think about the full range of activities that they can engage in, because kids are not so different than adults, right? They tend to turn to snacks when they're bored. They tend to turn to snacks when they're stressed, when they're emotional, right? And so thinking about how do you notice what might be happening with your kid, and instead of pointing out to them, right, offering them that substitute so they can begin to say like, hey, when I'm bored, I can play a game. When I'm stressed, I can, you know, listen to some music or talk to my mom or my dad about it, right? And so they're starting to build those habits that they can carry forward in life rather than feeling bad about the fact that they've created this kind of coping mechanism for themselves.
Yes. And when you talk about, you know, eating together as families, I'm wondering, when people decide how many meals they're going to eat a day, what do you suggest? I think we kind of grow up in an environment of breakfast, lunch, and dinner, right? But then later, some people never have breakfast. And you hear about, oh, you should always eat a good breakfast. Or some people are like, I'm never hungry till noon. And so I eat lunch and dinner.
or some people skip lunch as a way of they feel like I'll eat a breakfast and I'll skip lunch. That will help me lose weight. And then I'll have a big dinner. Is there anything that says a quote number of meals, or what do you suggest when you're having those conversations with kids and parents?
Yeah, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think the first thing that I always like to talk about is how when we're born, we are perfectly intuitive with our eating, right? If you've ever spent time with a baby, it's like every couple hours that baby is crying. It wants
2.5 to 3 hours.
Yeah, right. And you can't, you know, there have been some really cool research studies done where they've shown if you try to water down a baby bottle, right, that baby will cry for more food. If you double up the formula in the bottle, that baby will stop eating halfway through, right? And so it's like babies are perfect at kind of regulating what they need to eat and how often they need to eat to grow that the way that they're supposed to, right?
Right.
And then we in our society, we do a lot of things to kind of interrupt those intuitive feelings, right? We go to school where we have to eat lunch at an early time of day. We get jobs where we might not be able to take a break when we want to. We get busy, right? We go on diets and we feel like skipping a meal is going to be the right way to go. So there's all kinds of things that our culture does to kind of quiet those intuitive feelings that we have. So I think if you're still feeling hungry and full, right? Like if you still have those natural feelings of hunger and fullness, I think that's the best guide, right? When you're hungry, you should be eating. When you're full, you should stop. If you don't feel like you can trust those things, then the best thing to do is kind of start first with a routine where you're eating breakfast, lunch, dinner, and maybe a snack or two, right? And then you're doing that for a couple weeks and then seeing how your body responds. Some people aren't hungry right away when they wake up in the morning, and they never will be, and that's okay. They don't need to force that every morning. But you want to kind of give yourself that opportunity, but getting back on that routine, then you can sort of see how your body responds after a couple of weeks. I think the thing I really try to encourage people to avoid is skipping meals. So when you go a really long time without eating, what your body does is it slows way down, right? And it tries to suppress those feelings of hunger. Mm. And then after a while, those feelings of hunger come back, and often you overeat, right? You're starving, right? Like right. And you don't have a lot of control over what you're eating. I often talk with patients about, you know, if you ever gone to the grocery store when you're hungry, you were just like throwing food in your cart, right? And you don't even care what it is. And if you go all day long without eating, right, it's like you're throwing food in your mouth at the end of the day and you don't care what it is, right? And so you want to show up to meals hungry, but not starving, because you want to be able to plan and be thoughtful about what you're eating. And you're not just, you know, throwing food in your mouth because you're starving. And so I really discourage people from skipping meals. I think that can be harmful to your metabolism, and it can make it really hard to regulate your eating.
So many things. I wonder too, there's a thing, like, I think I've noticed this too. Like if you get on a roller coaster thing where you're eating bigger meals, all of a sudden you want to eat more, you know, during those meal times. But if you learn to scale back a little bit and not eat, you know, I don't want to make it sound like you're starving yourself, but not eat till you're stuffed or you're super full. You're going away from the table comfortable, or just a little bit feeling like, oh, I could eat more, but I'm not going to. I do notice then it feels like it's, I don't want to, I don't know if the term shrinking stomach is appropriate, but that the amount then you start wanting to eat after doing that for a little bit is less, that you don't need to eat as much as, you know, you did when you were feeling like, oh, I'm nice and full now. And then you almost feel uncomfortable later. Can you talk, is there a sense of how much you eat, and does it keep, I'm not even sure how I'm trying to express it is right, but
I mean, you certainly can, you know, over time, like you certainly can like stretch out your capacity of your stomach to eat more. So that's, you know, we see that in patients that say have had a gastric bypass surgery, and then, you know, they start to eat larger and larger portions after, and they can kind of stretch that capacity of their smaller stomach back out. I think the other thing, though, is really kind of losing track of those intuitive feelings, right? I keep bringing that back up, right? And it's sort of like, how good are you at listening to your body? And I right. think if you continually eat past the point of comfort is kind of maybe what you're talking about, like where you're eating and eating like that Thanksgiving meal, right? You're ignoring those signs, right? You're ignoring that initial sign of fullness. And then I think the more often that you do that, the easier it becomes to do that, right? And food is good, right? Like we all enjoy the way that food eats. And I think as humans, we are kind of driven from an evolutionary perspective to eat, right? It tastes good, it feels good, it's comforting. And so there's nothing wrong with those feelings, but it's sort of recognizing that the other feelings that we have, if we really listen, are those feelings of hunger and fullness, right? And so kind of trying to balance and making sure that we're paying attention to those over time is really how we're going to be sure that we're eating kind of a healthy amount for our bodies over time as well.
I want to take another short station break, and I'll be right back.
In Minnesota, Mother Nature loves to play tricks.
Oh, no. You can't fool me. This is fake spring.
But there are certain undeniable signs that spring is just around the corner.
60 degrees? You're just trying to get me to put my shovel away.
Like the KFAI Spring Member Drive.
Keep the snowblower primed and ready.
Just go to kfai.org and click donate, because in this time of uncertainty...
Honey, please come to bed.
Not until I see what that low pressure system does.
Isn't it nice to be able to count on KFAI? KFAI, non-commercial, community-powered, rock-solid radio.
And this is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. And I love that last bit. Non-commercial, people-powered, stable, grounded radio. Well, they didn't say exactly those words, but you get the idea, Charlene. 612-375-9030
is KFAI.org.
Yep, KFAI.org is where you can go. And we really do appreciate your pledge and your feedback as well. Hopefully you enjoyed listening to that last bit that was from Dr. Katie Loth about eating disorders and eating habits. And it was a really fun show. I love our interviewing, Charlene, because I feel like I learned so much from everyone. Like, I don't presume to know when I have somebody on, depending on what the topic is. There's so many times I know like almost nothing about the topic, but I learn a lot. And that's why I do it, because I presume other people like to learn, and you don't know what you don't know, right? So, did I just hear a door open? Maybe not. So anyway, 612-375-9030 or kfai.org is where we are. Charlene, you've been with me for several years now.
Like 10, 11?
Has it been that?
Yep.
Might be. So yep. What do you like about doing this?
I like this, our show, because we can get a topic and we just don't do the flash, you know, this is blah, blah, blah. We get to take it apart and we can find the people that are involved of whatever that particular thing is being discussed, and we get down into it, not just walking around it.
That's right. So yeah, I feel like we really do get to kind of the meat of the topic, and that we can dive pretty deep in about an hour. Remember, my show used to be a half hour, and it was in some ways a perfect length. You could, you know, I remember interviewing another podcast and they said, we like our show a half hour because it keeps it fresh and it keeps it good. And that's true. You can last about, you know, 10, 15 questions, bang, 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 and you're done. But if there's sometimes topics that you can really dive into and really find out about, and you just can't do that in a half hour. That's when an hour show really works. So let's take another listen to another show that we did. And then we're going to come back and we're going to talk to our listeners. Meanwhile, 612-375-9030 or
kfai.org.
Thank you. Here we go. We speak with Joel Snyder. Joel's a PhD and author of The Visual Made Verbal, a comprehensive training manual and guide to the history and applications of audio description. Joel, can you hear me?
Wasn't sure if you could hear me.
I can hear you.
Wonderful.
Thank you so
much.
Thank
you for having me.
Oh, yeah. So I want to start out by having you give us a little bit of history about you before you got into audio description and leading up to that. Just like a brief history.
Sure. Sure. My background is principally in professional theater and media. Ever since I was little, I wanted to be on the stage. part of that is just using my voice, obviously. When I was an undergraduate in college, I had the opportunity to read books for a blind college student. University of Maryland, yeah. And that led to doing some recording talking books for the Library of Congress here in the Washington, D.C. area. And that led to my learning about the Washington Ear, which is a radio reading service. Sam, you probably know all about those radio reading services.
Yes.
And it allows, of course, people who are blind or otherwise where print is inaccessible, they can hear the newspaper being read to them or magazines and such. And I auditioned and was thrilled to be accepted as a reader. My assignment, my principal assignment, was the Washington Post on Sunday.
Oh, wow.
So, and I remember even back then in the 70s, when we got to a picture, a photograph or a illustration, a graphic, gee, what do we do there? You can't read that, and we would just describe it, obviously. But there was no such thing as audio description, a formal kind of way of describing images. We just sort of did it off the cuff. And I was there at the Washington Ear, and around 1980, the founder of the Ear, Dr. Margaret Fanstiel, a blind woman, was on a committee at Arena Stage, the main regional theater here in the D.C. area. She was on an accessibility committee, and that was rarely done in those days, especially. But there was one meeting where the theater introduced assisted listening. Wow, this was a new thing. Of course, it's ubiquitous now, but assisted listening makes the sounds more accessible to people with hearing loss. Mm. And Margaret figured, well, if it's just a microphone on the stage, why couldn't you have a second channel and have a microphone off the stage where a person could describe what's going on, using the pauses between bits and pieces of dialogue. And Arena Stage said, well, we've never heard of that. And Margaret said, well, I've never heard of it either. It didn't exist. But she came back to the Arena was willing to give it a shot. She came back to the studio. She grabbed me. I had a background in theater, an English teacher and such, and a couple of others. And we hammered this out. What would we do? What would we call it? Audio description. And in 1981, in the summer, the world's first ongoing audio description service was born, describing a production of Major Barbara at Arena Stage. 81. So it began in performing arts, Sam.
Oh, my goodness. 81. Wow. And so then if for all those who kind of now have the idea of audio description, so talk a little bit about how the audio description is different from closed captioning.
Oh, sure. Well, of course, they're kind of mirror images in a sense. Closed captioning And of course, the general public knows about closed captions because they see them on television when maybe they're in a bar or they're at the gym. And those closed captions allow sounds to be rendered in a form that's accessible to people who are deaf. So closed captions are not just the words that you hear, but sounds. And they're rendered into text that a deaf person can see. A blind person, of course, or someone with low vision, the captions are not going to help so much. Mm-hmm. They might to a certain extent, but description is really a separate audio track that's added into a program. Once again, using traditional audio description, using the pauses between bits and pieces of dialogue. So it's an audio thing, whereas closed captions are visual.
Can you talk a little bit about what, you know, now that there's audio descriptions in movies and theater and shows, and what are some of the challenges that come with describing live theater as opposed to film or TV?
Oh, my. Yeah. This is a great question because, I've been doing this since the beginning, so about 45 years now. And I've been active in all of those areas, including museums. Again, it began in performing arts. And the challenge there is to know the play as thoroughly as possible. Take notes, even develop a script. In the early days, you know, maybe we saw the show 2-3 times, took notes, and then based on those notes, we would insert verbiage in those pauses between bits and pieces of dialogue or critical sound elements, and do it sort of off the cuff. Nowadays, it's probably most audio description in theater is still done that way. I've been researching and hoping that we can find a way to make audio description available at every single performance in a theatrical run. Part of the way we did it back in the beginning, it was all volunteers. And so really you saw the production 2-3 times and then you did the description only at 1 or 2 performances.
Right. That's often still how it happens.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So my thought is, what if you hired a describer like a cast member in a way, but they would go to some rehearsals. They would see the production developing. They would talk to the director, the scenic designer, the actors, and develop a script for the audio description. So no more of this totally off the cuff kind of thing. But it would be then available opening night. And at every single performance, the describer could go home. Unlike a cast member, the describer could go home if there's nobody there to listen to him or her. So that's something that we're experimenting more and more with. Another answer to that problem is recorded audio description. But I'm not a big fan.
Yeah, that timing for live could get events, really tricky. If anything,
yeah,
gets
for
off.
Live events. Anything can happen on stage,
right.
and the technical side of it is much trickier to work out. It's timed to light cues or sound cues, and that can have, there can be difficulties there.
Yes.
Plus, the recordings are generally not available until 2-3 weeks into the run of a show. A lot of shows are closed by then. and of course, a blind person could never go to an opening night. So that's the theater scene, if you will. And it was only, oh golly, about 3 or 4 years after we started doing description for theater in Washington that Barry Cronin, who used to work at WGBH in Boston, he heard about us and he thought, wow, this would be great for television, for VHS tapes, even that sort of thing. And he knew how to sync the audio description sound with the sound of the television program,
oh, cool.
Which is something we didn't know about really. But he knew that there was a secondary audio program channel, a separate audio channel that was there for Spanish translation, but wasn't being used much. And he thought, well, we could use that for audio description. And so we did a pilot for them. In fact, I wrote and voiced three of the very first television programs ever with audio description. They were broadcast in this pilot, and it worked. People got the hang of it. It made sense, and WGBH ran with it. They started developing their own program for broadcast television. They started doing description for VHS videotapes. Mm. Remember those, Sam?
Yes. And, I don't like to admit that, but I do.
Yeah. Then later DVDs and such. So they were really the first major producer of description for television. And then for the occasional film, we're lucky that now just about every film produced in the United States.
Just about, but I can just still about
has
find
an audio
some.
Description track. Largely due to awareness of the Americans with Disabilities Act. You know, what good is a movie theater to somebody who's deaf if there are no captions on the screen? What good is a movie theater to somebody who's blind if there's no audio description? So the movie theaters realized that, and the movie producers realized that. And now, as I say, just about every film coming out has an audio description track with it. And in fact, getting closer up to the present, even the streaming services have embraced audio description so that it's available worldwide. And in fact, they produce audio description oftentimes in 12 or 15 languages. So that's a great thing. We've come a long way over 4.5 decades.
Yes. I have seen several kids' movies that I've recently seen that has it. Sadly, though, I can still find some stuff on TV or Netflix even that's not audio described.
Oh, yeah.
And it really, I'm like, it kind of saddens me because this should just be something that's built into the system.
No question.
It shouldn't be a problem with that. And I don't.
No, I'm with you 100%. the problem is, when we're talking about commercial development of films and such, the filmmakers and the broadcasters, basically they choose what will end up with description. And if it's a new film, sure. But a lot of those producers have thousands of films in their archives, in their libraries. Is it worth it to them to develop description for things that, things like that, that are in the public domain,
though,
where there isn't much demand for it? And that's why a lot of those programs won't have description. So, and you've bumped into that, Sam. We're working on that too, trying to raise money to get. One idea is to get all of the films on the Library of Congress registry of films, get all of them available with description and captions, because these are supposed to be, the finest films ever produced. And we're working on raising some money to try and make that happen.
We need to take a short station break, and we'll be right back.
Friday nights are for the curious. Every Friday from 5 to 8 p.m., you can enjoy Discover Science After Dark at Science Museum of Minnesota during Museum Nights. On-site are immersive exhibits, omni-theater movies, local brews and bites, and adults-only entertainment, all happening in a relaxed museum environment. Tickets and more information can be found at smm.org/mn.
Concerned about colon cancer? You can take steps to protect yourself. It's recommended to get your first colonoscopy at age 45 or older. Colon cancer often has no warning signs, especially in its early stages. Minji Digestive Health can help. A Minji colonoscopy is a test that detects and can help prevent colon cancer. When cancer is caught in its early stages, it's most treatable and most beatable. You can learn more about the prep, procedure, scheduling, and their compassionate care team at mngi.com. That's mngi.com.
KFAI.org and
KFAI.org.
Oh. Exactly. 612-375-9060. thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed that piece on audio description with Joel Snyder. He's a fascinating person, tells great stories. And this is KFAI, by the way, you're on, and you're listening to Disability and Progress. I'm Sam, and that's, what is your name again?
What?
Your name?
Charlene Dole.
Oh, Charlene. Yeah, that's right. That's who it is. Okay. But we are in the midst of Pledge Drive and really appreciate all and any pledges and all support that you give. 612-375-9030. Did I say 60? It's 9030. Whoa. Sorry. Somewhere somebody's dialing a wrong number. Don't do that. Hang up. 612-375-9030 or KFEI.org. And Charlene, you remember we did the Waymo?
Yes.
Which is what I'm really excited about. Those automated cars. By the way, for the local people, Waymo is, they're doing an automation vehicle day at the Capitol, and I expect to see you there, Charlene. I'll be there.
Yep.
excuse me. But for all those out there that are currently riding Waymo vehicles, you are so lucky, and I would love to hear your experiences. If you have experience riding them and want to share your story, you can email us at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. We'd love to hear from you. Or if you just have questions or want to shoot the breeze, you can do the same. So let's go to listening to the last segment is Waymo. We may not get through it all, but we'll do our best with Angelica Price and Amanda Ventura. Here we go. We are speaking with Amanda Ventura and Angelica Price Roca. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Hello, ladies.
Hello. So nice to be chatting with you both again.
Again, I know. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. We're talking about Waymo, and it's such an exciting topic. Before we get really started, thanks for your time, by the way. Can you give the listeners who maybe didn't hear your first, you know, broadcast, give them a little bit of history of who you are and what you do for Waymo? Just a quick 30-second blurb.
Of course. And this is Amanda. I'm on the public affairs team at Waymo. So my role in particular at the company is working with road safety advocacy groups, disability advocacy groups, mm-hmm. and really helping bring education and awareness around mobility needs in our communities. And so a big part of that is working with people who have disabilities and hearing their stories, bringing them to Waymo, and vice versa, introducing the community to Waymo and then bringing them internally to us too to provide feedback and insights into their lived experience. It's really important to us that we're building a service that, you know, is going to actually be useful for the people that we want to serve. So for those who actually don't know what Waymo is, Waymo is a fully autonomous ride hailing technology company and service. And so what we do is very similar to other ride hailing services. There's an app on your phone where you can hail a completely empty vehicle to come and take you where you want to go within our service areas 24/7, and there's no one in the car. And so, you know, there's obviously a ton of really wonderful implications here for our road safety, which we can get into in a little bit, as well as the accessibility space and our riders with the additional needs. And that's what I'm so excited to get into. That is,
yeah, we will get there. I have several questions here on the docket here.
Love it.
And will Angelica be speaking with us today?
I think she's going to be a fly in the wall today.
Okay, good enough.
I'm here to listen to you brilliant ladies talk about this exciting topic.
Excellent. Well, thank you for attending and your time. So we'll get to the Minnesota part, but I want to start at least just briefly by, I know you are expanding into Minnesota, and that is hugely exciting for me because obviously I live here. But how does Waymo decide what state you're going to expand into. And how many are you in now? I know before it was X amount. So how many have you added, and how do you decide where you're going to go next?
You know, so much has happened since we last talked, and I think that was just last summer.
I know.
So Waymo is currently publicly available in 5 U.S. cities. So that's Los Angeles and San Francisco, Phoenix, Austin, and Atlanta. But we have since announced that we're going to be driving and eventually serving several more U.S. cities. We've even announced that we're driving around London and Tokyo. And so there's so much on the horizon. So when we are thinking about where we're going to go next, I mean, it's almost like, where aren't we headed at this point? There's so many cities in the United States that we want to serve. Some of the ones that we've already announced include Miami, DC. Like you mentioned, we're going to be thinking more about the Midwest, so Minnesota, Missouri, and thinking more about even Michigan, which for those of you who have listened to other interviews, you know that we also had a presence in Michigan for a little bit. And so I'm really excited to see so much growth. And I think it's just going to increase. When we're thinking about where we're going to go next, you know, it's really about like, what can we learn from these new areas where we're going to be driving? So the first, you know, 5 cities that we've launched in have been kind of in, you know, sunnier places.
Right.
And of course, I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about snow and weather.
We are going to.
And, you know, that's one of the interesting things is that now that we have our 6th generation driver and we have thousands of miles of experience on, you know, various inclement weather roads, you know, we're feeling more confident in driving in these areas that get a lot of snow and have near freezing temperatures and all of the really fun things that you Minnesotans
tolerate. All the things that we tolerate. When you're young, I think you love the snow when you're like 8 or something. When you get in your 30s or later, I think you think, oh, I don't know. Unless you're a ski bunny.
You're welcome to relocate to Phoenix anytime. It can be fun.
Yeah, I'm kind of happy that we don't have so many poisonous things here. That's just, you know, I'm a gardener and I kind of don't. I like to know mostly of what I'd stick my hand down on now.
Fair enough.
Let's start out. I wonder if you could tell me what do you see autonomous vehicles changing the transportation for people with and without disabilities? Like, how do you see transportation changing for them?
Sure. I mean, some of the benefits of autonomous vehicles are that they are driven by a driver, which is what we call our technology, the Waymo driver. So the Waymo driver doesn't get drunk, distracted, drowsy, didn't just break up with its girlfriend, you know, isn't getting angry on the road. You know, 90%+ of crashes on our roadways are caused by some element of human choice or error. And, you know, the technology that doesn't have those same fallibilities has this huge benefit to make roads safer. Right now, we're losing about 40,000 lives on U.S. roads every year.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to these segments, these little bits of teasers of what we've been doing through the year so far. And if you have suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. And you can also pledge at 612-375-9030 or
kfai.org.
We really do appreciate it. We've had a lot of fun doing these interviews. We truly believe in the mission of making education for all, and hope that you do too. And if you listen and you hear it, you must believe it, so please show it. 612-375-9030 or
kfai.org.
Good night, everybody. And Fresh Fruit is up next. And we're pretty sure all the stuff we've been saying from here is the KFAI board would like. So let's see.
Accessibility benefits.
This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. The views expressed on this show are probably those that the board would love. I'm Sam Jasmine. Charlene Dahl is my PR research person. We've been listening to episodes of the past couple, several weeks that we've done. Feel free to pledge 612-375-9030 or kfei.org. You can email us as well at disabilityandprogress at samjasmine.com.